Black, Lisa Lampanelli, Howie Mandel, Meryl Marco, David Brenner, Wendy Liebman, Gilbert Gottfried, Bobby Slayton, Carrot Top, Trey Parker, Drew Carey, Bob Saget, Phyllis Diller, The Passing Zone, Doug Stanhope, Fred Willard, and we've had him on once before, but the director and creator of The Aristocrat, Mr. Paul Provenza.
Thank you very much. I was into the bebop thing.
Yeah, you're wearing a beret.
I'm wearing a beret, yeah. I wore a beret specifically because of Mike Jones' theme song.
Yeah, well, it's very beat. You know?
It is very beat. It's very bop.
Do you know that the Kerouac, I'm excited about this. I mentioned this several times on the show. But it's the 50-year anniversary of On the Road.
I did not know that.
And they are releasing a whole new version that has all the stuff in it that people editors crossed out.
Oh, really?
More racial stuff, more sexual stuff.
Oh,
more
excellent.
Drug stuff.
Oh, excellent!
Imagine drugs in the on the road.
Have they approached you to do the book on tape version of this?
Well, you know, because of my Massachusetts background,
yeah.
Because Kerouac is from just a few miles from where I'm from in Massachusetts.
I see.
And you know that? Do you know also about Kerouac that English is not his first language?
I did not know that.
He was French-Canadian, as you might guess by the name Kerouac.
Okay. And does that inform the part that was cut out?
Maybe.
Is that the crappy attitude?
They cut out 5,000 A's.
Yeah, no, every time he said sacre bleu, they crossed that right out.
It also, so, On the Road, eh? That was the original title of it. On the Road, eh?
Well, the first time
so
I read...
So Dean Moriarty, eh?
The first time I read On the Road, I was actually on the road, and I didn't finish it because I left it in a diner on the road. Got back in my car and realized I left. And... the first time I was reading Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I was on my way to Vegas and I left it on the plane. Somehow I feel like it seems right.
Sure.
I've gotten a lot of good books by picking them up like that.
Yeah.
I have.
I want to know what happens when they clean out those pockets, because there's great stuff in those pockets and they're never there when you get on the plane. They always clean them out.
Well, it's the same as anybody that cleans up anything. They find stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, guys and stuff like that.
I think that they're charged with making sure they don't leave it, because I used to leave magazines, like, you know, Time magazine that I just bought, finish reading it, leave it in the back for somebody else to enjoy the magazine, and they're never there. I don't know what the deal is, if they have like a deal with the magazines that they, you know, promote on the plane or something like that. I don't know, but I also wonder
the interesting
if people
part
are
of the
leaving
story.
Porn and stuff in there.
The interesting part of that story is that you were reading Time magazine.
Oh, yeah, why? We
I
have
don't
a problem
know.
With reading Time magazine.
Once they put some stuff on the cover that angered me. I'm done with Time magazine.
Yeah, you know what do you get? You know, you're in an airport. You got an hour and a half flight. You know,
that was the time that my one wish came true. I was traveling across the country, and doing our little show. You know, and I'd finished reading the paper. I'd finished my book. I had nothing to read in another leg of the journey. And I went to Robbie and the other guys in the crew and said, you got a book that you finished with or something? And they all said no, they were all planning on reading. No iPod, no nothing, no computer. I'm going to do another 2-hour leg of the journey. I got nothing. So I run into the little gift shop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at the bestsellers, which are horrible. And I can't, and I can watch garbage on movies, but I can't, like, read garbage for some reason.
Well, I have flung the only John Grisham book I ever read.
Yeah.
When I finished it, I threw it across the room and I actually dented, you know, the wall.
Yeah.
I actually took the wall. I was so curious.
I'm looking at all these.
Yeah.
And I'm there in Robbie's, you know, these swords are small, but he's at the other side of it. And I go, you know, I just wish I had, like, one of those top American short story books. Right? And this woman who's between me and Robbie reaches into her purse and goes, Penn, you've brought me a lot of joy here. And she hands me America's Top Short Stories. And she hands it to me. I hold it in my hand and I go, and a cure for AIDS with a patent in my name and a 12-inch penis. Is that too late? And, and Robbie went over to me and said, only you would waste the one wish you have in your life on a short story book. So,
well, they're good stories, really.
It wasn't that good a book. I thought it'd be a great, you know, because I remember when I was in high school, the American Short Story, and I think it's because they were short.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also, you know, the stuff you read in school is sort of classic.
Yeah.
A lot of the new stuff, it's kind of like sitcoms. You know, I always think that the sitcoms are a maligned form, but I actually think they're the TV version of the short story, you know, relative to the novel or something like that. That there's actually, if you do them right, that sitcom form is perfect for certain ideas encapsulated in a way that's technically really difficult, you know? And you know, you go back to old shows like the Dick Van Dyke Show or Mary Tyler Moore or whatever, they're almost, I think they sort of elevate the form of sitcom, you know? But like the crap that you see on TV, you also get crap short stories.
But what I think you're wrong about one thing on that, which is a short story, one of the most powerful elements of it is that most often the character is profoundly different at the end than at the beginning. And in the situation comedy, what I find unfulfilling about that is almost by definition, your characters can't change in one show.
Yeah,
they can. There's overall arcs.
Yeah. But no, I agree with that. But that's not a standard I was referring to. Because, I mean, the thing about writing a sitcom is really, really hard. To write a really good sitcom is really, really hard because of the nature of that half-hour structure. And it's very hard to do three acts in a half hour. Even, you know, even when you're dealing with just basically funny stuff, that's just a hard thing to construct.
What sitcoms have you done? What have you been regular on a few?
We have to go there, really.
So, have. You know about it a little bit, right?
Yes. you know I'm the scourge of primetime.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
You want to kill a show, you
Captain
bring me in
Death.
For a fourth season. you tired of those long hours? Get Provenza on the show.
What, well, you took over Northern Exposure, right?
Janine Turner.
Northern
we have Exposure. Email from Janine Turner saying, to hell with you, Provenza.
Really? Has she come out of her trailer? That's a big step right there.
So you did Northern Exposure.
Yeah, well, that wasn't really a sitcom.
What is that?
It's,
I never saw it.
That's a one-hour...
I heard you were going to be on it eventually, so I just didn't watch to begin with, so as not to disappoint the ratings.
Not to skew the spikes. That's a one-hour sort of like a comedy-drama thing, sort of. But no, I mean, you know...
Now, do you call that a dramedy, or do you call it a comma?
I don't know. And Northern Exposure was one of those weird ones. Like, I guess kind of... Is House like that? Is House sort of comedy-drama, sort of?
I don't know. Not so funny.
No, there was a few of those. There were a few. There was a little flurry of that being like a new form of dramedy thing, but
or a comma.
And
what was the show? Did you do another one before, like Full House or something?
I did a lot of stuff. I did.
You really don't want to talk about
just
this.
Just listen.
No, I actually have no problem talking about it because there's some funny things to it. But I did Facts of Life.
Oh, okay, that's it.
I wasn't a series regular on that. I was a semi-regular in two seasons. But the beauty of that was I got that gig because I used to do warm-ups for the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. After I moved to L.A. and was just sort of kicking around. You know, warm-ups for a sitcom...
I think it's the hardest thing in the world.
It is so hard, but it's also a great gig. I mean, they pay you... first of all, it's union money, so you get your health benefits and all that stuff. And it's a steady gig, and if you're real good at it, you can do 5-6 a week, you know? And... but it's really hard because you're so confined in what you can do, and you're not really doing stand up. You're basically babysitting old people, you know, is what it is. And you got to have really quick improv skills, but you got to stay within very narrow parameters, and you never know how long any given break is.
Right.
You know, you don't know how long it's going to be before they're ready to shoot again. So you really got to stay on your toes. So they were hard gigs, but I did that show for several years, probably about 5 years. I was the warm-up guy, and they were always like, oh, we got to find a place for you on the show. And I'm like, yeah, great. Yeah, I'd love to do that. And and then I got a pilot, and they picked up the show without me. And
so you did a really good job because you said clearly to the people, anyone could do this. We'll get someone cheaper or more famous.
I didn't have to say it. They somehow knew. But so I did this pilot. It got picked up without me. I mean, it was really like they said, we'll pick up the show if you replace the lead. it's hard not to take that personally. In fact, it's irrational not to take that personally. It doesn't get any more personal.
And that show
Love
is Everyone
show
Loves Raymond?
Except him. It was the Paul Provenza show. I was running for the park.
Yeah.
But so they replaced me against the producer's wishes because he really wanted me to do the show, but the network
That's
was
what
like,
told you.
Well, wait, no. I say that. I say that unhesitatingly because I know it's true, and I'll get to this in a second. So he fought for me, whatever, and they were like, no, we want the guy who's less ethnic or whatever, and because, you know, I'm down with the brothers.
Yeah.
And, I wasn't white enough, basically, and they wanted a real Midwestern sort of bland kind of look or feel, whatever. And they got this guy, and so I get...
What was this, in the 40s, when Italians were considered Americans?
Hey, what do you talk? That's what I'm sure. Hey, you got a breeder's guide. It was called Ciccolini, the series. So they replaced me, right? But that same day that they called to tell me, hey, good news, the show was picked up. Bad news, not with you. That same day.
I would have done the other order. I would have said bad news. We didn't really get you in this, but there's good news for us.
Yeah, right. That same day, I get a phone call from the Facts of Life saying, hey, you know what? All those years ago when you were warming up the show, we always wanted to find a part for you. We think we got something. We'd love for you to do this. Would you come and do the thing? So I had just been, you know, axed from what was essentially my series.
There's nothing funny about that.
So essentially what I did was, my wife broke up with me, and that's essentially what happened. So I said, take it, because I was like, just get something. I have to have something, you know. So I went on to Facts of Life. I had a big thing with them where I said to them, I said, look, you know, I'm not right for this show. And they're like, no, but that's what we want. We're going to bring something else into the show. We're going to bring this different thing. And eventually,
you're the shark. We're going to jump.
That's right. That's right. So, and they were talking about, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, the show, we don't know how much more life the show has in it. And I said, it hasn't for quite some time now. They said, we want to spin it off. We think that you and Lisa and blah, 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 we spin you off and all this. So they convinced me to do the show. And, of course, I knew everybody, so it was a really easy, comfortable thing to go into. Okay, so cut to, I'm doing the first episode or two. I get a phone call from the producers of the original show that I was axed from saying, we're on our way to the network right now. We do not like the guy that they put in the show, and we're telling him that we either want you or we're going to pull the show. We're not going to do it. We're going to back out of the show because it's just not what we want to do. And they were on the way to the network going, tell us now if you'll come back and do it, otherwise we'll turn around.
What planet was this on where the producer stood behind you?
Can you believe it?
This wasn't Earth.
It's astonishing, right?
This was like Bollywood, at least. It was in India, right?
It's astonishing.
It's amazing.
Center. Yeah, no, that's what I'm telling you. That's why I say I know they were actually serious about it. So they went back to the network.
They couldn't lie about that.
And they brought me back in with a nice, hefty little, gee, sorry, we shot you in the head, you know, can we patch the wound up thing. And that went for 13 weeks and went nowhere. But so that's why I took...
They brought you back in to a show you were fired from?
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Oh, Ken, you don't know.
This is like losing your dog and he comes.
You know, we've known each other for a long time, but we've never actually. I tell people some of my stories, my career stories, and so many people have said, like, you know, everybody's got a few of those, but you've got like dozens. It's astonishing. I mean, you knew about the Northern Exposure thing, right? But did you know that it was between me and Rob Morrow the first time for the original cast?
No.
Yeah. And then about halfway through the run of the show, Rob was talking about leaving the show. He was asking for a huge amount of money. So the network ultimately gave in and said, look, we'll pay the overage because he was nominated for an Emmy in between this phase when they had gone already started going to find replacements for him.
Uh-huh.
Whole different set of producers at this point. But they open up to recast the show and bring in a new lead, right? I'm in the box.
Uh-huh.
Tested at the network. There's nobody against me. He gets an Emmy nomination. The network says, we'll give him whatever he wants. We don't want to change horses in midstream, especially right after an Emmy nomination. So I don't get it a second time. Then he's leaving the show for good, for real. Whole different set of producers. I audition for it. Get the part. And then they cancel it.
Yeah, 6 hours later.
Is that amazing? Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, you know the Conan O'Brien story.
No.
That was between me and Conan for the late night spot.
Oh, I didn't know
who,
that.
Who won that?
The better man. Yeah, Leno was
It freed you up to do a lot of new other projects.
Yes, it did. It freed me up to do that project I've been working
on. Epic.
Yeah, that was a wacky thing. That Jay Leno was actually responsible. Jay Leno actually brought me into that and was pushing me like crazy.
But Lorne Michaels had some muscle on that, too.
Exactly.
And he went with one of his writers.
Exactly. But it was a real 11th hour decision. Where what happened was I had done a showcase. When the time slot opened up, right, they went to Jay Leno because they realized they had nobody on deck. They realized they just never thought about it, and they had nobody on deck, and they didn't know where to go. So they obviously had a relationship with Jay Leno, and they know that Jay goes out to the clubs all the time. So they hired him as a consultant to say, you know what's out there, you know who's in the club, you know the skills it takes, you know who can do that. So, you know, give us like a top 10 list of people we should consider. And at that time, I had a show on Comedy Central, Comics Only, and he said, well, you know, if you want a guy who can do this stuff, why don't you get a guy who's already doing it? And so Jay made tapes of me on Comedy Central and sent them to them and got the late night people all into me because they were like, oh my God, he is actually doing it. You know, there actually is somebody on deck. We just never go to those channels, so we didn't see that deck. This is back when Comedy Central was the stealth network. And so he brought me up to them, and they were really like championing me then. But because they had no name to push, right, to the affiliates who aren't required to carry the late night programming, they had to sell the time slot without talent attached. They had to sell a time slot that had no show in it yet. So they brought Lorne Michaels in so they could say to all the affiliates, well, here's the guy that, you know, was behind Saturday Night Live, and whatever it is that he does is going to be great and cutting edge and blah, blah, blah. So they got all the affiliates on board. But part of Lorne's deal was that he had complete control. So they figured Lorne's going to come up with something. And then every day Lorne brought them a different member of the cast of Saturday Night Live as potential host for a talk show. And they were like, well, no. And so then they said to Jay, look, we're really worried about Lorne. What do we do here? And Jay was like, Provenza's your guy. And so Lorne said, okay, well, I'll see everybody that Jay is talking about. He was furious that they had even been talking to Jay. Like, you know, how dare you second guess me? So he said, I need a showcase. I know I want to see everybody do stand-up. And the network calls me. I'm at a gig somewhere, like in Boston or something. Network calls me, I'm in to do this showcase. And I'm like, well, why do I need to do a showcase so they could see me as a comedian to give me a talk show when I have 150 episodes of a talk show? Why don't they just look at that? Well, no, it's Lorne Michaels, blah, 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 blah. So I wasn't going to do it, right? But then I feel bad because Jay had extended himself and sure, really got behind me. So I called Jay and I go, what do I do? And he's like, hey, you know, you should do it.
That was a good Jay.
Thank you very much. Hey, we'll be right back. So I cancel a gig for one night. I fly from Boston to L.A. to do 10 minutes on a showcase at the Improv for Lorne Michaels, and then fly back to Boston to do this gig. I never hear anything for weeks and weeks and weeks. So one day I just call Jay out of the blue to say, hey, thanks for pushing me. Thanks for being in my corner. I appreciate it. And he's like, yeah, just couldn't have got any closer. It was really intense there. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, you don't know? I said, no. He goes, oh, yeah, well, it was pretty close. You know, I got to go. And he hangs up. So I call my manager and I go, hey, I heard it was pretty close. What's the story? And he goes, let me find out. He calls me back. He goes, you don't want to know. I go, I think I do. It turns out that NBC and Lorne were having this huge fight, which, of course, didn't matter because Lorne was going to have his way, but they were doing everything they could to say, please don't give us an inexperienced guy. Let us do a thing. And it turned out to be like this 11-hour thing with guys in China, you know, Chinese food stains on their shirts, not going home to sleep for 2 days, trying to convince Lorne, and it didn't work. And so that was my brush with greatness.
So we have Paul Provenza on. We'll be back with more stories.
We're not going to be back. They've canceled it.
Sorry, the scourge of prime time.
Oh,
with shows with a man who should be bitter but is still good-natured about it. This is Pegelletta, CBS Radio, Free FM. Yeah, this is Ben Gillette with Michael Goudeau and the beret-wearing Paul Provenza.
Cool daddy-o.
Who's telling us showbiz stories. So you
nightmare stories.
You wrote and directed starred in... No, you didn't star in The Aristocrats at all, did you? You don't appear in it at all.
No, I have a small little cameo. And a snap at the end.
Snapping with the goats.
There was no writing involved.
No.
And you're being very kind and generous and removing yourself from that equation.
But in that case, you know, that's an interesting question because you chop stuff up so much. There isn't a sense. There's certainly composition.
Yeah. It's hard to call it writing, but it definitely. But you know that the tricky thing, which actually you were very diligent about policing, was that in that edit, in that sort of creating a through line and stuff, that it never became inauthentic and it never became something other than what it actually was by putting it in a different context, which was really the tricky thing.
Well, that is the tricky thing because, you know, when we're doing Bull's hit and the other stuff that we do, we get huge amounts of raw footage. And as Michael Moore has demonstrated very, very well, and as Sasha has demonstrated very well, with enough footage, you can tell any story you want. You know, the people that... put together the Ozzy Osbourne show.
Yeah.
You know, they could have done a weekly tragedy or a comedy every week with that much footage.
Right.
And it really does take a great deal of willpower to always go back and say, well, you know, they've got to really be saying what they're saying. We can't make them say the opposite.
Yeah, especially when, you know, when there's actually no real statement being made, but somebody being funny. Like, there's a lot of stuff we could have done to make people's pieces much funnier, and that was really hard to resist because there's really no downside to that.
Right.
You know, but that was really hard to resist.
We had that, you know, we wanted to put Lenny Bruce in it.
Yeah, right.
You know, we had all the tapes of Lenny. And we had him saying stuff that fit perfectly in with the Aristocrats. And if you listened to just that, you were sure he was telling the Aristocrats. But there was stuff on either end of it that made it clear he wasn't.
Right.
You know? And it was a very famous clip, and we could have gotten permission for it. And that was one of the hardest kind of moral decisions to make. And it's great that there were moral decisions to make of the Aristocrats.
It's a tad ironic.
but it was kind of nutty. So since the Aristocrats, what have you been doing?
Toiling in obscurity. That's what I do best.
Now, you were in town a while ago for the some sort of Vegas comp. What the hell was that? We didn't even hear about it.
Rightly so. No, it's called the Las Vegas Comedy Festival, and it's an odd thing. It's really industry. It's really like, you know, it's for young comedians or comedians who are just sort of at a certain level in their career trying to get to other levels. They want to network. They want to meet people. They want to hear about pathways. They want to hear alternative routes to achieve certain things. What are the realities? Yada, yada. So it's kind of like a lot of seminars and little talent competitions and stuff like that, which really are interesting because if you win the talent competition, that's what you win, is that you won the talent competition. But then you get to put on your resume or your promo, winner of the Las Vegas Comedy Festival competition, and hope that buyers confuse it for the HBO Las Vegas Comedy Festival. So it's a very interesting thing they got going. but it's real yeoman work in comics, some of whom have been, you know, really working the trenches for a long time and just want to find different paths and avenues they're not familiar with in the business. And some people who are just starting out and don't know what to do, however, and just getting there. So it's a weird mix, and you never know what you're going to see on any of the shows. You know, one guy will be like a pro, a solid pro, is really, you know, worthy of constant work, and then somebody will be an innovator and doing something really interesting with a unique voice, and then somebody will be somebody who really should have stayed at the Dairy Queen. So it's kind of interesting.
And did you see good people?
Yeah, a couple of really good people. It's really young guy named Sean or Shane, I think it's Shane, Mouse, M-A-U-S-S. Of the Spiegelman Mouses. and he was really, really terrific. I mean, a really unique voice. And it seemed he had that great thing that's kind of cool that I see as a kind of trend in a new generation of comedy right now, which is it seems like it's really not very skilled or crafted, but it actually is. You know, I don't want to get into the questions of the authenticity of that or the manipulation of that, but he was terrific at it. It was so clear that he had so much skill and craft but it really seemed like he was kind of, you know, working his way through it, but he knew exactly what he was doing. He was really, really good. Very smart stuff. He had one line that was just killer. Oh, he goes, oh, no, this was another guy. His name escapes me. It's a three-act thing, and he worked with a guitar, which, of course, you know, is hard to overcome. But he had another great voice, sort of a dark Stephen Wright-ish kind of thing. And he had one line where he just all of a sudden stops and goes, I wish I could remember his name. He just stops and goes, you think Rosa Parks was real good at musical chairs? You know, something.
Okay.
Some really good stuff like that. It's just skewed, just kind of makes sense, kind of doesn't, you know.
And then another guy, Mike Green,
who was terrific. This guy, Mike Green, who really sort of created the illusion of not being at home on the stage, but actually it was just brilliant craft character work. And those are the first three I saw out of 12 people, and they knocked me out. And that's pretty good percentage. 3 out of 12. Real original
voices
out of
12. That's almost a quarter.
Almost.
Ed, what seminar were you doing?
I'm just talking about some cutting-edge comedy because it's kind of something that I've been working at. You asked me what I'm doing since The Aristocrats, and I'm involved in a number of, unfortunately and against my will, spec projects about some cutting-edge comedy. And basically it's a way to sort of get attention on some ideas and things that people are doing in the comedy world, but they're not getting any attention, and it's kind of staying hidden. It's the comedy equivalent of doing something about punk when punk is still trying to come up, you know?
Your little Legs McNeil of
exactly.
comedy. Now, last time you were here, you told us a lot about doing comedy in Dubai.
Right, that's part of what was driving me, was that I've been going all around the world and seeing so many different people with so many different angles and cultures they're coming from and stuff, that it was like, comedy really is becoming global. I mean, like, in a serious way. Like, I found out about this comedy circuit that's coming up in Nigeria, of all places, and it's the kind of thing
you should be able to make some real money over there. I get these letters from them. They got money to just throw away.
I am going to finance this thing. I just have to send $1,200 for some paperwork.
And your account number, yeah.
I got $25 million coming to finance this project.
You're gonna do comedy in Nigeria?
Well, no, it's not that I'm going to do it there, but my point is that when comedy in Nigeria is interesting because it crosses over between political activism. So you get people sort of getting up in town squares and gazebos and things and just starting shows, which are really, about the culture and the politics, which is illegal over there. But they're doing it in comedy, so there is no definition. If you're doing stand-up comedy in that way over there, you're taking a political action. And it's interesting because it's not just a question of whether or not you're going to do something that's politically valid or really making statements, or you're just going to be fluffed. There's no question. If you're doing stand-up, you've already crossed the line in places like Nigeria. So they have some real interesting stuff
happening
there. Now,
you've been to the airport that it says at our airports you can't go to, right?
Lagos, yeah. Yeah, the Lagos airport. I was arrested twice.
Now, why?
At the Lagos airport.
Oh, there's a lot of questions on this.
But I should say I was arrested three times at McCarran. I was arrested in the technical sense of being detained and questioned, but not actually like cuffed and taken to jail.
But first of all, why were you in Laos?
Lagos.
Lagos.
I was in Lagos because I have the travel agent. The brochures.
You're trying
so
to get
nice.
To Atlanta.
Seriously. It was Lagos or Detroit.
So, why? What were you in Lagos for?
I was in Lagos because I was traveling with a couple of friends of mine who are world travelers. They actually grew up all around the world. Their dad was a chemical engineer and used to work under governments around the world. And he was in semi-retirement and had been lured out of semi-retirement. Apparently, he's a chemical engineer of note. Uh-huh. And the Nigerian government had asked him to come and help work on a nitrogen fertilizer plant in Nigeria as part of a government project. So he was over there with diplomatic immunity and all of that sort of stuff. And so they were going to visit their family. And on the way, we did a little traveling in Africa, Kenya, Tanzania. And then we spent some time in Nigeria. Nigeria is probably the most horrendous place I've ever been to on earth.
Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah.
Christopher Hitchens says, don't even think about Korea. Don't even think about Iran. The place that is going to be the most danger to us is Nigeria. He said he had never been to a scarier place in his life. And that's Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that I would say in opposition to that statement is that they would have to get along themselves first in order to be trouble. And I can't see them causing too much trouble because they just really don't have it together.
When I was in India and China.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe. I mean, I thought that the world was more like the USA than it really is. I mean, I really did.
Well, there is a very clear definition of first world and other.
Yeah.
The difference between second and third world has gotten a bit vague.
Uh-huh.
But first world is a very clear and distinct.
Well, they don't even use that. That's now considered racist, right? It's not developing.
Perhaps it is.
Yeah. And so what?
I don't know. Can you be a developing country for 150 years? At some point, calling it a developing country at that point alone is sort of somewhat judgmental.
Yeah, exactly.
The fluid's gone bad.
I tell people about India, you know, and some of the places I went, because we weren't in the touristy places.
Right.
We went to where the magicians are,
right.
And the magicians are a very low caste, rightly so. and so we were in, there's Delhi, then there's the slum of Delhi, then there's the slum of Delhi, which is Chattapur, which is where we were.
Right.
But Nigeria's worse. And how, I don't know, what is it like? How long were you there?
I was there for about, between a week and a half, 2 weeks, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Because a week in India, a week in Egypt, is to me like half my life.
Well, you have to understand that my friend's dad, because he was a guest of the government working on this project, he lived in a gated community.
Uh-huh.
And when I say gated community, I mean armed guards, yeah. Armed uniformed guards, not rent-a-cops, you know, government thing. It's a huge separation, and you know, they have to protect people because it is a violent, angry, horrible place. Roadblocks everywhere.
I have to take a break.
Yeah.
And then we can come back and just have Paul Provenza talking about Nigeria. People are going to call
up
and just go,
by the Nigerian tourism.
Turn it on now. Yeah. Turn the show now. Paul Provenza's talking about Nigeria on Pendulette. Pendulette. I forget my name here. Pendulette show on CBS Free FM. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette on the Free FM, CBS Radio. Sitting here with Michael Godeau, as always. 866-570-PEN is the phone number. PennRadio@gmail.com is the address, PennRadio.com. And as promised, we have Paul Provenza talking about Nigeria. So you're living in a gated community in Nigeria for a week and a half.
With a, you know, driver and all that sort of stuff. But that's the dad of these friends of mine. But we wanted to go out on our own, so we would go out on our own. But we'd have to go with the car and driver because it's just not safe. Nigerians hate white people. It's that simple. I'm sorry. That's not a racist statement. It's just a fact. They just hate them. Part of it is culturally they just despise the West because they kind of feel screwed over. That, you know, in the 70s, the big oil boom, all of a sudden all the big companies came in and governments started giving them all sorts of money to try and, you know, create the relationship with Nigeria that they never had before, and they're building all these projects and everything. The bottom fell out of the oil market. Everybody just left. There's half-built factories that are just overgrown with weeds and jungle. Roads with overpasses that just stop halfway through the air, you know. I mean, really, it's like so clearly everybody just packed up and left. So they just have this tremendous rancor to the West and white people in particular. And everywhere you go, there's a million uniforms. Everybody from, you know, the dog catcher to, you know, military to the mailman to parking meters, they all are armed and have uniforms, and you can't tell.
The parking meter people have arms?
Yeah, and you can't tell what uniform is what, because unless you're from Nigeria, how do you keep track of all that? So anybody with a uniform knows they can go up to any Westerner and hassle them and get paid off. The entire country runs on bribery. It's unbelievable. You know, you take a photograph of like a, you know, hot dog stand or something. There was a nightclub called Caesar's Palace.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I had just worked at Caesar's Palace, and so I wanted to take a picture of Caesar's Palace. the franchise in Nigeria. And so I took this photograph, and I get hassled. Three, you know, armed guards come around me, taking away my camera and everything. Of course, I wasn't doing anything illegal, but they knew I didn't know that. And they, and basically, they get you to give them, you know, some vig everywhere you go. And at the airport, we were stopped three times, detained, cameras taken away, bags taken away, whatever, just having to bribe people. And constantly on the phone to his father, going, calling somebody else, who would then call the right person. An hour and a half would go by, and it'd be five phone calls from the government to get us to free. So they wouldn't
do
have
they it. Speak English?
Yeah, they speak English. Yeah, they speak English. But mostly just awful things. It's just horrible. I mean, it's just like there's absolutely nothing good about being there. It's horrible. And you know, you and I are very, very different about this. I like traveling. I like being in odd places. I don't mind the hassles. I like all of that stuff, all the stuff that makes you sick of traveling. I generally can get behind and just look at it as an experience, a ride of some kind. Oh, my God, I could not wait to get out of Nigeria. It was horrific.
But didn't the father know enough not to invite you?
Yeah, but, you know, he wanted to see his family. You know, he wanted his sons to come.
Sure, his sons, you, Provenza, who sang sitcoms. Why are they watching Nigeria? Maybe there'll be an overthrow of the government because you're there?
I was the hostage in case of anything. I was there to be taken hostage. I was the proxy.
Why lose the sons?
Exactly.
Right, we can have you there. So you've traveled extensively in Africa.
Not extensively in Africa, but, you know, just a handful of places.
No, you didn't do any stand-up.
No, I didn't do any stand-up. There wasn't much there. That's what I was talking about before. It's really grown up to be an international language. It's unbelievable. And you know what? It is a purely American art form, and it is being seized around the world. Some people are doing, you know, more with it right now. It's like, I guess what happened, you know... you know, people got a hold of jazz and did their own thing with it. Yeah. You know, it's very similar.
But the thing with jazz is that the language, the vocabulary of jazz is 100% American.
Yeah.
The combination of African cultures and,
and
you know, Western music forms kind of jammed together there. And if you go into any country without any English speaking at all and start into the changes of Bye Bye Blackbird, they can join you.
Right.
But isn't the comedy done in English, or is it done?
There is English-speaking comedy all around the world. Uh-huh. There's a lot of work. I do a lot of work over there for English-speaking expat audiences all around the world, and they're everywhere. And they're huge audience everywhere. I mean, it's astonishing. You know, in the Middle East, some of those countries, like, okay, United Arab Emirates, which is basically Middle East light, but their population is 80% expat, and that includes probably about 80% of that 80% is, you know, Filipinos and Indonesians that are in the service trade, you know, the chambermaids and bartenders and stuff, you know, busboys, and the rest of it is English-speaking, Australians, Canadians, Americans, Brits, over there opening, you know, regional offices of TGI Fridays or, you know, teaching the kids of other people living there, whatever. It's huge, and they're hungry. And
thank all it's Friday.
Thank all it's Friday.
T-A-I-S.
The rules are really cool. The rules are really cool working over in the Mideast, because you cannot say anything about Islamism at all. I mean, not whether even if you can say anything good about it, just being in that context is considered, you know, disrespectful. And they have actually undercover cultural policing shows and things like that. So the English-speaking audiences know that that's what you're up against. So they can watch you navigate it, and that becomes another level of funny.
But doesn't the person that is the cultural spy in there also know how you're navigating it?
Yes, but if you navigate it successfully, you're okay. Like, for example, I went over and I was talking about Islamism, but I was using Christianity in the jokes.
Uh-huh.
I was talking about all religions.
Uh-huh.
But I spoke about Christianity.
I see.
So that if push came to shove, I was actually saying things that they would say.
Uh-huh. Sure.
But the audience knew that I was saying stuff about them.
That it was broader.
Yeah, and that's fun. It's really fun, but, and it's also really a little bit dangerous. I got thrown off a couple of radio stations.
Yeah, you told us about being shipped right out last time.
For asking where Osama bin Laden was.
and saying, the first thing they told, well, it's repeating it, but for those that didn't hear it, they said, whatever you do, don't talk about Islamism, and absolutely do not talk about drugs or prostitution, which are rampant. You know, so they don't want you to mention that, because it's not supposed to be there. And the first thing they asked me was, so is comedy the new rock and roll? And I said, if so, there's not enough hookers or drugs in my life. And I said, okay, we'll be right back. And I was out the door. But It is fun working over there. It's weird. It's really weird. But that thing, that trying to ride that line. So, but I had friends who were, you know, knocks on the door at 4 a.m. and they taken out of the country, you know, because they crossed some sort of a line.
But just taken out of the country.
Yes.
No.
Not taken out and shot.
Right. Exactly. That's a big difference.
Sent home. Well, that's
UAE.
So bad.
You know.
And what's the level of living over there? You know, because that was the weird thing when we were traveling. We were going to really street magicians,
right?
And then driving back to the 5-star hotel,
right?
You know, except where we couldn't do that. Like in China, there are places we just weren't near enough to a 5-star hotel. But was that kind of thing for you? Or they're all rich over there, right?
Yeah, but I know there's some, you know, well, the Middle East, UAE, kind of Qatar, Kuwait, kind of thing. They're a little bit different because there is a lot of huge money there, and there's also poverty, as opposed to a place like China where there doesn't really seem to be any big money. It seems like everybody's poor, and everything that's really luxurious or rich is somehow involved with the West. You know, but in the Middle East, they have a separate existence. Like there's, like in the UAE, it's a dry country because it's a Muslim country, so there's no alcohol allowed, right? But they also know that they've got a vast number of Westerners that are needed to fuel their economy and the growth of their real estate business and their tourism and all that sort of stuff. So they have allowed a whole parallel universe that locals are not allowed to go to any of these places, but Westerners can.
So it's just little dens of iniquity, little decadent areas.
Big, with neon signs, and it's like just this sort of like waving in your face, ha, you can't have this.
And
you know,
locals really can't go? It's really...
Well, they do, because it's nothing but hypocrisy everywhere.
Yeah.
So they do go, you know. They just put on jeans, and they take off the dish dash, and they put on jeans and a polo shirt, and they go. And great story. The single highest grossing Starbucks in the world, according to the people who told me this, who were at this Starbucks, they said this is the single highest grossing Starbucks store in the world, was in Kuwait City, and it's the only one in Kuwait, and it's in the Hilton Hotel. And the reason it's such a high grossing store is because all the locals go there to have tea and sit and watch the Western women, because it's right by the pool.
I see.
So the place is crawling with locals dressed in Western clothes. They can sit and ogle Western women in bikinis.
Now, did you talk to locals at all?
Oh, yeah. Amazing. I mean, first of all, 14-year-old Russian hookers everywhere.
So it's like the slammer in that way.
and you know, this is the big, you know, religious country.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the hypocrisy is just rampant. You know, it's also, you know, if you get caught with a joint or involved in any drug transaction whatsoever, even in the United Arab Emirates, which is, like I said, pretty light, you will go to prison for life, and it's still the biggest transport point for drugs in the Middle East to go everywhere else in the world. You know, it's just, it's all payoffs and all, you know, hypocrisy.
So people do get caught and they just pay off huge amounts of money to not go to jail?
No, I think the people that are doing all the transporting and stuff are at a very high level, and those payoffs happen, whatever. But if you're on the street and you happen to have a little something, you know, whatever it is that you hash or whatever it is that you want, if you have enough for one evening for yourself, you'll go to prison for life.
Well, enough for one evening for myself is none. So I'd be safe.
That's how bad it is. You could still go to prison.
If they find out you don't do drugs and you're not doing drugs, then that's a Western thing to go to prison forever. I understand that. Our guest was Paul Provenza, world traveler, comedian, director, creator of The Aristocrats.
Available for weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Always a pleasure.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And this is Penn Jillette sitting here with Michael Goudeau. And we're on the Free FM, CBS Radio. And as always, it frightens me the awful truth of how sweet life can be. So long.
Yeah.